We're doing Parshat Matot, and as usual, we'll go through the Parsha quickly and then review it with more depth. Our Parsha begins with the leaders of Israel being taught the laws of vows. We have two types of vows, Neder and Shvua. A person is obligated to keep his vow. A father whose daughter takes a vow, so depending on her age, the father can annul her vow. A woman who's married, her husband can annul her vow. And if a person transgresses the vow, it's a serious sin. And that brings us to Sheni. We are commanded to take revenge from the Midianites, and we have 1,000 people from each tribe going out to war. Pinchas is the Kohen Mashuach Melchama. They go with the Chatzotzos, with the trumpets. They attack and they destroy all of Midian. And we're up to Shlishi. They return to the camp and they bring the women with them. And Moshe gets upset. How could you do that? The whole war was because of what the women did. They caused us to sin. Now you bring them back. So they took all the women who had caused them to sin, and they killed them. And then they gave them the laws of purifying themselves and purifying the vessels. And here we have the laws of purging flavor from vessels and the laws of Tevilas Kelim, and we're up to Revit. Then we take an accounting of the loot and the division of the loot. Some of it is given to the Levites, some of it is donated. And that brings us to Shishi. In Shishi, we encounter the tribe of Reuben and Gad, who see the tremendous territory on the eastern side of the Jordan, and they have a lot of cattle. And they come to Moshe and they say, let us build corrals for our cattle, and then let's leave our families here and settle this part of the land. And Moshe says, you think you're staying here and everyone else is going to go fight to war? You guys have to join. What are you going to do? Get everyone to give up on conquering the land of Israel? And they said, no. We meant, let us settle our families here, and we will go in and conquer the land of Israel with the people of Israel, and then come back. And Moshe makes an agreement with them. And from his agreement, we learn how you make conditions in halacha. We have four laws of conditions that are derived from here. And then we have the description of how they actually conquered and divided the eastern side of the Jordan. And now let's review the parsha with more depth. We have a Mishnah in the end of Chagiga. The Mishnah tells us we have different laws. Some laws in Torah have many verses. Some laws in Torah have few verses. And other laws in Torah seem to have no indication other than our tradition. One of those laws is the laws of HaTorah Shnedarim, the idea that a rabbi can annul a vow. So we do have a derivation from a pasuk, but if not for our tradition, we would never derive such a big concept from a pasuk. We have a tradition on it. Now, the whole concept of a neder needs to be defined. What the Torah tells us is that we have a capacity to affect things in the world with our speech. Let's say you have a book. You could say, I donate this book to the temple. I donate this book to the shul. I donate this book to charity. You take an item or you take money and you designate it. In your speech, you will have given that object or that money a different halachic status. So we know that you could take an animal, let's say, and say this animal is going to be an ola sacrifice, and from that moment onward you cannot derive benefit from that animal. That animal, once you've designated it as a sacrifice, so to speak, it is the property of the temple. You have to bring it up and fulfill your vow and make it into a sacrifice. That's called a nidava, that you've made this animal, you've designated this animal as a sacrifice. Then we have the concept of a neder, where a person says, I hereby take a vow that I will bring an ola sacrifice, a shlamim sacrifice. And that's a neder and a nedava in the context of the temple. The Torah teaches us in our parsha that you can do something else. You can say, this book will be prohibited on me the same way a sacrifice is prohibited on me. And that's the term of a neder in our parsha, where a person takes something and says it is prohibited on me just as a sacrifice would be prohibited on me. Just as an animal that was designated to be holy is prohibited from my own benefits, I can't use it for my own benefit. By the same token, this object will be prohibited from me. So you understand, if that is the form of a neder, if a person says, I make a neder that I won't sleep, that's ridiculous. There is no such concept as, I make a neder, I won't sleep. Because we said a neder, by definition, is that an object is prohibited from me as a sacrifice would be prohibited from me. I can make a shavua. What is a shavua? A shavua is a vow. So I could swear I won't sleep tonight. That has validity. But if I say a neder, I won't sleep tonight, that doesn't work, because neder is relevant to objects. Shavua can be relevant to people. Yes? Okay, so we have a neder and we have a shavua. Now, neder and shavua doesn't only apply to the temple. The law that the Torah tells us in the beginning of the parasha that you have to fulfill what you say, that applies to donations. If a person takes a vow, he will make a donation to the temple, or to the shul, or to charity. Whatever he says, he has to keep. And that's part of the connection in our parasha, that the parasha begins with the responsibility to stick to our words when we take a vow, and then it continues all the way through the end of the parasha, where Moshe tells Reuven and Gad and half the tribe of Menashe, you guys better stick to what you're saying. So the whole parasha is about being faithful, sticking to what we've said. Moshe gathers in the leaders. And remember, we're holding about a month and a half before Moshe passes away. This is the final generation that's going to enter the land of Israel. This is the final few weeks before Moshe passes away. And these are the final leaders. These are the ones that are going to lead us into the land of Israel. Moshe reveals to them that there is capacity to annul a vow. Now, there are two ways to annul a vow. One is called hafara, one is called hatara. Hafara is when a father or a husband annuls a vow. So a father, well, let's say his daughter, she's 12 and a half, and she takes a vow. She says, you want me to eat meat? I hate meat. All meat should be prohibited on me like a shlamim sacrifice. Her father hears it. He has until nightfall to annul it. From the minute he annuls it, it is annulled. So he could say, it's mufal, that vow has no validity. Let's say he didn't know it was a vow, or he didn't know that he could annul it. From the minute he knows, he has until nightfall. After nightfall, he can no longer annul it. He could take her to a rabbi, and then if the rabbi can, he will find a hatara, a way to annul the vow retroactively. A rabbi can find a loophole within the terminology that was used to annul a vow retroactively. Now this doesn't always work. It's not always so simple to annul a vow retroactively. And we have to know that the Torah is not fond of people who take vows. The Torah says you have the halachic capacity to do it, but you should know it's a sin if you do it. Even if you keep your vow. We paskin that it is prohibited to take a vow. When it comes to sacrifices, then sometimes you have situations where it's okay, or you even have to take a vow, that this animal will be designated for a sacrifice. But in general, the Torah sees it as a prohibition. It's improper that a person takes a vow, because what's a person doing when he takes a vow? What he's really saying is, by the honor of God, I promise that this is what I will do. So he's playing with something that's very scary. He's saying, by the honor of God. Why does a vow have weight? Because he's attaching God's name to it. Now, the way human beings work, it's more than likely that he will not live up to his vow, be it a neder or a nedava. And even if he does live up to his vow, we say, why did you use God's honor? There was once a rabbi here in Jerusalem who was in charge of the public fund. And at some point, there was someone who he took a loan from. He took a loan from one of the wealthy people in order to fund the needs of the poor here in Jerusalem. And we have to understand, in those days, when the poor needed help, it was a question of having what to eat or not having what to eat. This own rabbi's son would spend much of his days hungry, because here in Jerusalem there was a serious shortage of food. So the rabbi in question was Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's father. And he was in charge of the public fund. And the poor desperately needed food. And he went to one of the wealthy people and he took a loan. A sizable amount of money. And then he put together the money and he paid back the loan. But somehow when he paid back the loan, the receipt got lost. The person who got back the money forgot and came back and said, you have to pay me back the loan. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's father said, I paid you back the loan. And the man insisted that he did not. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's father didn't know what to do. So He couldn't really take more money from the public fund to pay back something that was already paid. So they had to go to court. They went to Din Torah. And the rabbi at the time, if I'm not mistaken, was Rav Salant. And Rav Salant said, in this case, if you take a vow on a Sefer Torah, if you take a vow, so then you will be absolved from paying back the money of the fund. And Rav Shlomo Zalman's father said, I do not want to benefit from the use of God's name. If I take a vow by God's name, that means I saved myself that expense by using God's name. No, I'll pay the money. And he was a poor man. He said, I'll save up the money and I'll pay it back. To which Rav Salant responded. Rav Salant said, no, you don't. Mr. Orbach, if you do that, you will put the whole trust of the fund in question. People will say, you know why he didn't take a vow? Because really he's not sure if he paid it back. You claim you are sure. Rabbi Orbach said, yes, I am. So then Rav Salant said, the court obligates you to take that vow. Rav Orbach was devastated. He couldn't argue with the court, and he did not want to benefit from taking God's name. But what could he do? If he wouldn't take the vow, so then the validity of the fund would be put in question in the public's eye. So having no other choice, he came to the court, and he took the vow. And so was absolved from paying that sizable amount of money. But he couldn't sleep at night. Here he absolved himself from paying money by using God's name, God's honor. So what he did was he started saving that exact amount of money that he would have had to pay. And when he saved month after month and year after year, when he had put together that exact amount of money, and remember, his own son was walking around hungry. They didn't have extra bread in the house. And nonetheless, he would save a penny here and a penny there until he got that money together. He then went and donated that money to a shul here in Yerushalayim, had a special section built for the public, and a plaque put up that said, this was donated by someone that wants no one to know who donated it. And the reason he wanted no one to know was because he said, I have to give back that money to God. I don't want to have any benefit from the money that I benefited by using God's honor. So that is the idea that the Torah doesn't want us to take vows. I don't know who spilled the beans. I don't know how we know today that he was the one who donated it. What? You could look in the biography on Rav Shlomo Zalman, so they actually show you the picture of the plaque. They show you where it is. I don't remember.
Wouldn't there be a Zayam for the person that you want to keep the secret?
I don't know who spilled the beans. I don't know.
Right?
I don't know. So the idea is, when a person's taking a vow, he's saying, by God's honor, this is what I'm doing. Chazal say terrible things happen in the world when a person transgresses a vow. And before the courts would allow a person to take a vow, they threaten him numerous times. They'd bring him into a dark room with one or two candles lit, and they'd show him a stretcher for a corpse. They'd show him open graves. They'd show him and they'd say, realize what you're doing. You're swearing by God's honor. And if you're going to lie, then that brings terrible things to the world. God doesn't take this lightly. It is one of the Ten Commandments. Lo tisa shem hashav. Do not take God's name in vain. The Aruch even writes that they'd blow up the equivalent of balloons in their day, balloons of hide, and they pop them behind him to scare him. And they take him around the court from room to room, and they tell him, are you 100% sure what you're saying is 100% accurate? The idea that the Torah allows a husband or a father to annul a vow is explained by some of the commentaries as stemming from a woman's inclination to be more excitable than a man. Meaning a woman might say something rash more easily than a man would. And so the Torah gave her husband the capacity to annul that. Very often when we see these things, so we take it the wrong way. We take it as chauvinism. Whereas perhaps we should view it the other way. That the Torah wanted us to understand that it is within her psyche, and therefore the Torah gave us the capacity to work with it. Not to look down at it, but rather to work with it. What vows may a husband annul? So we say either vows that afflict her. She takes a vow, I won't shower for a year. Poor girl. So, poor husband. So the second type of vow that he could annul is a vow that affects both of them. Something that involves the two of them. Let's say she says, I'm not going to eat Shaar Sudas. He says, I want my wife to eat with me Shaar Sudas. She says, I'm not a vow that all jewelry is going to be prohibited on me like a carbon. So she's taking a neder that prohibits all jewelry upon her. So that affects the husband. A normal husband wants his wife to wear jewelry. We even have halachos on Yom Kippur that a kala is allowed to wash her face because the nature of a chasen is that he wants a beautiful kala, and that helps the love grow between them. So
consider a chatan kala years down the road.
30 days. Oh, 30 days for her, she's considered a kala. After that, it still affects him, but it's not on the same level. So the two types of vow that a husband may annul is a vow that afflicts her, or a vow that is something that's relevant to him, something that's relevant beino leveina, between him and her. Yes? I just brought that as an example, that beauty is something... I didn't understand. What?
You said that even the kala can wash her fist in Yom Kippur. Like, at least the husband will spend the whole day in synagogue. It'll be, there is no chance for him to buy that books or something.
Well, the Mishnah tells us in Yuma that Chazal made a special leniency for a kala, that when she wakes up in the morning she could wash her face, because if she looks all frazzled as he leaves to shul, it affects the husband. You're right, he won't see her a lot, but the little bit that he'll see her, that also affects him. And Chazal felt that the way a person looks in the beginning of a relationship impacts the way people feel. After 30 days, we assume the relationship has solidified enough that that's not necessary. Chazal still gave recommendations to Akala. It says that the rabbis would give advice to their daughters what they should do so that they should find favor in their husband's eyes. And they gave very practical advice, down to the nitty-gritty of how to behave in the bedroom. So you see that Chazal gave it a certain amount of weight, that a kala should be alluring, and that a wife, even down the road, should entice her husband. We have the famous story in the Gemara in Tanis. We discussed it a week or two ago. We discussed it. So, Abba Chilkiah, when he'd pray, rain would come, and yet his wife would get all decked out to come greet him. You don't remember the story? It's a Gemara in Tanis. You guys know the story? Tov, we'll go off on a tangent. We'll take 2 minutes. Abba Chilkiah was out working in the field. There was no rain for a long, long time. So the rabbi sent messengers to him to ask him to pray for rain. Abba Chilkiah was working. The rabbis came to him and he wouldn't talk to them. When he finished working, he put his talis on his shoulder. He put the shovel on his other shoulder and he started walking. When he came to a puddle, when he went by thorns, he took off his... He lifted his robe. When he went into a puddle, he put on his sandals. When he came to the city, his wife went out to greet him. When he walked into the house, so she walked in first, and then him, and then the guests. And he offered the children to eat. He gave the older child less and the younger child more. And then he went, he told his wife, come, let's go out. He left the guests sitting there. He went up with his wife. He said, I know the rabbis are here to ask me to pray for rain. Let's go pray for rain before they ask. They went to the roof. He went to one end. She went to the other end. He prayed. She prayed. And clouds started coming from the side. She was praying on. And it started raining. He came down, sat down and said, rabbis, what'd you come for? So the rabbi said, we came to ask you to pray for rain. So he said, oh, good thing. You don't need me anymore. Look, it's raining outside. You see, you guys don't need me. So they said, not so fast. Now you got to explain to us what was going on. Why didn't you answer us when we came to greet you? They said, we know you tricked us. We know you went and davened, and that's why it started to rain. Why didn't you answer us when we came out? He said, I was being paid for my time. I was working for someone else. I couldn't stop working to talk to you while someone's paying me for my time. Why did you put the shovel on your shoulder and not cushion it with the talis? Well, the talis wasn't mine. It's a borrowed talis. So I couldn't use someone else's talis. I borrowed it to wear. I didn't borrow it to rest the shovel on, so I couldn't rest the shovel on that. Why is it that when you walked by thorns, you picked up your robe? He said, well, if the robe tears on the thorns, then I have to figure out how to patch it. If I scratch myself on the thorns, so the body heals itself. Why did you put the sandals on when you went through a puddle? He said, when I walked on the dry land, I could see where I was walking. When I walked through a puddle, I can't see if there's anything down there. So then I needed to protect my feet. Why is it that your wife came out to greet you when you came to the city and she was dressed up so beautifully? He said, well, my wife comes out to greet me to ensure I don't look at anyone else. Such a tzaddik. He's so careful with everything he does. When he goes up to Davin, it rains. All the rabbis know that when they need rain, they should go to him. And yet, his wife knows that to help him be such a pious Jew, she's going to go out and greet him dressed so beautifully. The rabbis were realistic. They didn't expect a person to be saintly. This concept that a person is such a saint that nothing affects him, he's not interested in anything. Most Jews don't live up to that concept. You see, even top rabbis like Abba Chilkiah didn't think that that was a level he should be on. It was normal. Normal people can be very pious and still be normal people. They're way beyond what we're like. But so Abba Chilkiah's wife comes out to greet him. They asked him, why is it that when we came to your house, you let your wife walk in first, then you, and then us? He said, well, I don't know you guys. I'm not leaving my wife out with you alone. So how come you didn't offer us to eat? I didn't have a lot of food. How come you gave the older kid less and the younger kid more? The younger kid is out in shul learning and the older kid is at home, if he's at home learning. So every time my wife is cooking something, I'm sure he noshes off of what she's cooking. But the younger kid, he's out of the house, so he has to have more food. He wasn't around noshing all day. Okay, so those were the questions, those were the answers. What? We did this story a week or two ago, I guess in a different context. Okay, at any rate, back to our story. So at any rate, you see, we went off on this whole tangent. We began by saying, what vow can a husband annul? A vow that affects him. We said jewelry affects him. And then we brought the example that on Yom Kippur, Chazal permitted a kala for the first 30 days after marriage to wash her face. And then we said, you see, that beauty affects the husband in a normal relationship. Normal people are attracted to beauty. And we brought the example of the story of Abba Chilkiah. That's the order of our tangents tonight. Now let's get back to the parsha. So the Torah tells us, let's say the husband annulled the vow, but the wife didn't know that he annulled the vow. So she takes a vow. She says, I'm not going to eat any chont. And the husband says, what? I'm going to spend all my Shabbos eating chont alone? So he storms out of the house. He bumps into his friend. His friend tells him, just say the vow's annulled. So he says, the vow's annulled. Meanwhile, his wife's at home and she's making him some chon. And as she's making him some chon, she says, boy, this tastes good. This looks good. This smells good. And then she takes some and she tastes it. Wait a second. Technically, there is no vow. The husband annulled the vow. But she didn't know that. He was out of the house when he annulled it. So the Torah says, God will forgive her. God will forgive her if she does tshuva. But that teaches us that when a person intends to do an action that's a sin, even if technically it turns out it wasn't a sin, a guy goes to the store and he buys bacon. Turns out it's Bacos. It's got an OU on it. It's fake bacon. He buys bacon chips and he munches on them and then he discovers, it's not real bacon. But he meant to eat real bacon. He has to do tshuva. So the Torah holds us accountable for our thoughts as well, as we will see onward in the parsha.
How is that? Because if you had intended to do a sin and you stopped yourself, then...
If you stopped yourself, fine. We're talking about where you did an action thinking that action would be a sin. God says to Moshe, go take Israel's revenge from the Midianites. Moshe tells the people, go take God's revenge from the Midianites. The Medrash says, Moshe said to God, why do you call it our revenge from the Midianites? The Midianites didn't have any issue with us. What's the reason there's anti-Semitism in the world? Why does the world hate us? Because we're your people, because we keep your mitzvos. So Moshe calls it Hashem's revenge, because Moshe, so to speak, argued back and said they only hate us because we're your people. As the Medrash said, the reason it's called Sinai is from the word Sin'ah, that hatred descended to the world when we became God's chosen people. No one likes someone who's supposed to be better than them. And the second Hashem said, they're my chosen people, the world said, we don't like that. The world had an option to do that too. Until today, the world has that option. That doesn't matter, the fact that the world can become a ger. How when we entered the land of Israel, Joshua wrote the Torah on stones, inviting everyone on the planet, you want to become Jewish, here's what the Torah said. He translated the Torah to every language, but no one was interested. They sent their emissaries, they copied it down, they brought back copies and said, we're not interested. But that doesn't mean we like them who do stick to it. Hashem says to Moshe, take revenge from the Midianites and then you will pass away. So what would the average person do? He'd say, God, I'll get to it. It'll take me a little bit of time. You know, I have a lot of things to take care of. I'll get to it. And then he'd procrastinate for a few years and extend his life. There was someone who did that. His name was Joshua, Yoshua bin Nun. But Moshe doesn't. If God says to do it, he does it right away. And very often when we try to outsmart Hashem, so to speak, it boomerangs. Chazal say Yoshua should have lived to the ripe old age of 120 like his Rebbe. But he didn't. He lived to 110 because he tried to outsmart God. And this is the same concept that we see over and over again in Tanakh. Joseph's brothers want to ensure that he will not rule over them. So they sell him down to be a slave in Egypt. And what happens? He comes out viceroy of Egypt. We see this concept. It's a repeating theme in Tanakh. Yes?
But why would Moshe want to stay on the He's got everything that he needs. He's at such a high level. And then he goes down.
So, it's a very good question. If you go online, on TorahForMe.org, this was a class we did in my sukkah, so they don't have it on Machon Meir's site yet. About 2 or 3 years ago, on Hoshana Rabbah night, we learned the Medrash. Hoshana Rabbah, usually we have people in the sukkah and we learn all night long. And we learned the Midrash about Moshe's conversation with Hashem when it came time for him to pass away. And the Midrash goes on for many pages where Hashem tells him it's time to pass away. And Moshe says, no. I don't think it's time yet because... And Moshe starts arguing. I have this merit, I have that merit. And God comes back and Moshe comes back. And there's an argument that takes mamash pages long. Every time Hashem says, you gotta go. Moshe says, no, but wait. I have this claim and that claim and... The Medrash goes on and on and on. And you read that Medrash and you have to ask the question, like you just said, why would Moshe want to keep living? Hasn't he accomplished everything? So, the greater a person is spiritually, the more he appreciates life. Life is opportunity to produce. Life is opportunity to gain mitzvos. Life is opportunity to advance the world. The closer a person is to Hashem, the closer a person is to the concepts of Torah, the more he loves life. And the more he tries to hold on to life for whatever he's worth. It is a person who is self-centered that doesn't love life. When a person thinks only of himself, so then life isn't worth living so much. Because if you think about yourself, well, how much do you really get out of life? If you think about what you can really accomplish in the world, if your goal in life is accomplishment, so then there's a lot to live for. The greater a person is, the more he wants to live. So Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't think we have anyone like Moshe Rabbeinu that Midrashim described how much he fought for life. You see, David HaMelech also tried and tried to gain life. Because life is opportunity to accomplish. And when a person's life is about accomplishment, then every day is cherished. Every second is cherished. So Moshe wants to keep living. And even so, when Hashem says, go do the mitzvah, he does. The nation doesn't want to give their volunteers. Why should we give people if you're going to die? Now suddenly they say, no, we don't want Moshe to go. So each tribe had to force 1,000 men. Now the Midianites were a tremendous army, but they could only fight with people who hadn't sinned. Those who had sinned with the Midianite women couldn't volunteer to fight this war. And so each tribe put together 1,000 men. The Midrash says there were 1,000 who went to war from each tribe. And there were 1,000 from each tribe who went to support them, to prepare the food, to watch over the camps. And there were another corresponding 1,000 who stayed behind to pray. And this is a phenomenal concept, that everyone had his correspondent prayer. Person who was responsible to pray for him to succeed at war. We find that when King David sent his men out to war, initially he would lead them to battle, until at one point they said, you know, you're going to do us much better service if you stay behind and daven for us. Pinchas leads them to war, either because Pinchas was the one who started the killing of the Midianites, he's the one who stood up to the leader of the Midianite girls who seduced the head of the tribe of Shimon. So he was the one who was to lead the conclusion of this battle. Or else because Moshe, who grew up in Midianite territory, did not want to be the one to destroy Midian. And this brings us back to this concept that a person has to have hakarat hatov, a recognition of what good he received from someone, some place, or something. And the greater a person is, the more appreciation he has. And this is a concept that we will see time and again in Tanakh, and maybe we should take a minute to explore it. Why does a person lack appreciation? Because a person has false pride. A person feels like, I deserve it. Why shouldn't I have that? I could give you a million reasons why I don't have to show appreciation to anyone. Why should I show appreciation? You know what I did for them? Moshe probably helped the Midianite economy, and he probably did a million things to help the Midianites. We know of different wars he fought. And yet Moshe has appreciation for the Midianites. Moshe has appreciation for a piece of land. Moshe has appreciation for the Nile that protected him. Because the greater a person is, the more he can show appreciation. And this goes hand in hand with humility. Because what does it mean to be humble? It means to recognize my true self-worth. To recognize how much of what's going on in this world is God and how much of it is me. To be humble doesn't mean to think I'm worthless, but to be humble means to be truthful. To recognize that the reason I am what I am is 99% God and 1% me. I better do my 1% because it's going to make all the difference, but it's 99% God who gave me the capacity to see, to speak, to think. Who had me born here? If I were born out in an African village, where would I be? I'd be hunting monkeys. Why would I be any different than them? Why am I here? Because I was given many, many opportunities. I was born to parents who educated me. I was born with the capacity to be literate. I was given so many gifts from above. So what is it that I can take credit for? My capacity to speak? That's not mine. I don't control whether I can speak or not. Well, what can I take credit for? My capacity to see, to think, to feel? I can take a minuscule amount of credit for the minuscule amount of free choice that I have. But there's a tremendous amount that's beyond my choice. I didn't choose what generation to be born into, what family to be born into, what religion to be born into, what society to be born into, what skills to have, what strengths to have. So when a person is humble, what he's really being truthful. Humility and truth go hand in hand. And if he's being truthful, then he also realizes that he should have appreciation for many things. You guys with me? So then it's also logical that the greatest prophet, Moshe Rabbeinu, had the most humility and also repeatedly shows the tremendous hakarat hatov, the tremendous appreciation that he has, because he doesn't take anything for granted. Why does a person take something for granted? Because he says, I deserve it. Why shouldn't I have it? That's the big mistake in life. That's when we start being upset in life. That's when we start being disappointed with life, because we expect we should have better. So Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't fight the war against the Midianites because he says, I grew up there. I shouldn't be the one to destroy the Midianites. They take the trumpets to war. You guys know the Medrash about Bilam and the flying carpets? No. Okay. So the Medrash says that Bilam went back to lead the war with the Midianites. And Bilam was a great sorcerer. So he had the Midianites fly on carpets. And what?
Really?
Yeah. That's what the Medrash says.
They went up.
What?
Bilam went up.
Right? Oh, very good. So, Bilam was leading the war. And Pinchas came with the Aron, the Ark, and Pinchas was dressed with the garments of the Kohen Gadol, with the Urim V'tumim, and the Tzitz, which has God's hidden name. And he goes out to war like that. Now, Pinchas also traveled to that famous wall. You remember that wall that the donkey smashed Bilam's leg against? Well, that wall was the pile of stones that Bilam's great-grandfather, Lavan, had built together with Yaakov. And they had agreed that if anyone crosses that wall to harm the other, they would be killed by the sword that was placed in that pile of stones. So Pinchas goes there to uncover that sword and takes the sword out to war with him. And when they go out to war, Pinchas is intent on killing Bilam. Moshe told him, I want you to kill Bilam. I want to see Bilam dead. Bilam caused the Jews to sin. Bilam purposely said, Lo hibit aven b'Yaakov ve'lo ra'a amal b'Yisrael. I can't hurt the Jews because I see no sins among the Jews. Bilam, even within his prophecy, was alluding to the Moabites and the Midianites. You want to knock them down, get them to sin. So yes, he's prophesizing. But like every prophet, he can stick his personality into the prophecy. And so Bilam purposely tells them, I see no sins, so I can't harm them. And he's alluding to the Moabites, cause them to sin and you'll be able to harm them. And that's why Bilam has come back, because Bilam figures, now that they've sinned, I can take down the Jews. Now I'll be able to curse them. Bilam wants to get good pay for all he's done. 24,000 Jews died, so he comes back and says, I want pay for what I've done. Pinchas is headed out to kill Bilam. Bilam has gone from being prophet to sorcerer. He sleeps with his donkey. He does all kinds of sorcery with his male organ. He does all kinds of prohibitive things, and he also encourages the Midianite daughters to cause Israel to sin. And so Bilam deserves the death penalty. And so they go out to war. And when Pinchas reveals the tzitz, the people come falling down off of their flying carpets. And he says God's hidden name in order to fly up and give chase after Bilam until he kills him. They take the trumpets with them. The trumpets have exceptional power. The trumpets are used to give sanctity to the Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, the holidays. We would travel based on the blasts of the trumpets. When we'd gather, we used the trumpets to gather. And when we'd pray in a time of war, they use the trumpets. The trumpets, like the shofar, represent prayer. There are two types of prayer. There's prayer where a person asks for something. There were two children, a brother and a sister. And they both wanted a candy that their father had bought. So the brother says, I'll show you, I'll get it. And he walks into the father and he says, Dad, look, I know you got this delicious candy. And I'll tell you what, if you give me the candy, I'll make my room for a week. Father says, no can do, goodbye. And he says, no, Dad, really, I really want that candy. And if you give it to me, I'll be the best boy in the world. And he starts arguing to and fro. And by the way, he finishes and his father says, goodbye. So the kid comes out and he looks at his sister and he says, didn't work. There's no way we can get that candy. Wonder what Dad got that candy for. So the sister says, watch. She walks into the room. She doesn't say a word to her father. She looks at him with glassy eyes and lets a tear start dripping down her cheek. And she looks at her father. Her father looks at her. And she looks at him. And another tear drips down. And she turns around and walks away. And her father runs after her. And he says, "Honey, what's wrong? Why are you crying?" And she starts bawling. And he says, wait, what's bothering you?" And she starts weeping. And the father doesn't understand what's wrong. And he is so touched. He says, "Look, if it's about the candy, I was going to give you both the candy anyways. It's just I want the candy for another day. It'll be Shabbos, I'll give you the candy. But if it means so much to you, I'll give it to you now." And she gets the candy and she walks out with a smile. There are two types of prayer. One is when you talk. And then you could say all kinds of things. And sometimes there are all kinds of answers. And the other is when you don't say a word. You just start crying. And crying is a reflection of the deepest feelings. And when we blow shofar or when we blow the chatzotzrot, what we're expressing is a wail. We're not saying a single word. All we're saying is we're crying. Yivava. We are weeping. We didn't say anything. What we're saying is, "Abba, it hurts." What we're saying is, "Help me. I'm not making any argument other than the fact that you care and I hurt." What was the girl telling her father? "I know you care, so let me just show you how much I care." That's the blowing of the trumpets. That's the blowing of the shofar. The people finish the war, and then they go to gather the Midianite women. Moshe had intended that it be just an attack. Attack them, destroy their wells, harm them. They wipe out all of the Midianites. And they come back with the cattle and the women. And Moshe comes out of the camp and he sees they brought back the women. Now remember, in previous wars, they didn't have this because previous wars, everyone was defiled. Everyone went to war. So there was no point in the people who went to war staying outside the camp. Everyone was tamei. But here that it's only 12,000 men, so Moshe goes out to them, and he gets upset. "How could you do that? What'd you bring the women back for? What was the point of this war? The whole point was because of what the women did to us. How do you bring them back alive?" Chazal tell us that whether you're right or wrong is irrelevant, but when a person gets upset, so then a person loses. When a person gets angry, if he's a prophet, he loses his prophecy. If he's a wise man, he loses his wisdom. If he's an ordinary, intelligent human being, he loses his intelligence. If he is a plain, sane person, he loses his sanity. When a person gets upset, he loses. So Moshe Rabbeinu got upset, he lost his prophecy. For those few moments, and that's why in a minute we're going to see that when it comes to the laws of purifying the vessels, Moshe is not teaching. Elazar is teaching. Because Moshe was upset, so he wasn't focused enough to teach. He forgot. They sanctify themselves, and Elazar teaches them the laws of purging vessels. What are the laws of purging vessels? So the Torah teaches us ta'am ke'ikar. The flavor is like the thing itself. What's an example of that? Let's say you take a piece of pork and you slice some onions on it and you put the onions on top of the pork. You start slicing the pork and the onions and then you pick up the onions, you wash them off and you say, "Okay, let me eat the onions." We say, "No, you know the onions have pork flavor in them." You say, "Yeah, but no, there's no pork here." We say, "No, the flavor is like the thing itself." Let's say you take some pork, you boil it in water, and then you take out the pork. The water soup of the pork has pork flavor in it. So that's prohibited. We say the flavor is prohibited like the thing itself. Now, we have another concept that the vessels absorb flavor. When you use a vessel to cook something in it, it absorbs flavor. Now, I never understood this until came Pesach time, and I had to clean vessels. I cleaned out our vessels. I filled them with water. I cleaned out some pots. And I filled them with water, and I turned on the heat. I started boiling the water, and as the water is bubbling, I'm starting to see pieces of fat in the water. So I said to myself, nah, I probably didn't clean it well enough, right? Poured out the water, took the strongest detergent, started cleaning all over again, cleaned it perfectly, again filled it with water, put it on the fire, boiled the water, and again I found pieces of fat inside. I did this 3 times until I said, okay, this is what the rabbi said, what can I do? You know, each time I said to myself, I can't be, right? I didn't believe it. You know, I learned these halachos, but I said, it doesn't make sense to me. But Chazal say it. Chazal say that vessels absorb flavor. And if you cook in a vessel, so then the flavor comes out of the walls. So, if you buy a vessel, a used vessel, from a non-Jew, so then the assumption is that the non-Jew used it with non-kosher food. How could you use that vessel? They captured vessels from the Midianites. How could they use the vessels? So earthenware vessels, well, you could never purge the flavor from an earthenware vessel. Maybe if you put it back in the hot furnace that it was made in. But technically we say you can't purge an earthenware vessel. But when it's relevant to you, Allah HaLamayis, ask your shayla. A metal vessel, so we say kibboleo kach poleto. The same way it absorbs is the way the flavor comes out. Meaning there are levels of absorption. Something that's used directly on the fire, the grate of a grill. So then we say, just like it absorbed through direct fire, the way you can't get it out without using direct fire. Now, if you heat it up, if you do libun, if you heat it till it's red hot, so you know the sparks are coming out of it. So then we say that it's not that the flavor came out, but you burnt the flavor within it. There's no more flavor left to come out. If you made it so hot that sparks are coming out of it, well then you burnt whatever flavor was inside. So that works for everything. Meaning if you want to do that, even on a pot or anything else, you could do that. But you realize that some pots are going to be destroyed if you do that. You take a blowtorch to a Teflon-coated pot or frying pan, that's it, you lost it. So we say, okay, what about a pot? So we say a pot absorbed through water. You cooked things with water in a pot. So then if you want to purify it, if you want to get the flavor out, you re-boil water inside, you clean it, and you wait 24 hours. We'll explain why. And then you boil water inside, and then the flavors come out of the wall. Why do we wait 24 hours? Because we say, the halacha tells us that for the first 24 hours after a vessel was used, the flavor in the walls of the vessel is a positive flavor. After 24 hours, that flavor is no longer positive. So, technically, after 24 hours, you shouldn't have to do anything. There's no good flavor coming out of the walls of the vessels. But the rabbi said you should. The rabbi said you can't use it that way. You have to kosher it. So after you've waited 24 hours, you boil the water and the flavor comes into the water. Then it gets reabsorbed into the walls. But this time, when it was absorbed into the walls, it was absorbed as a lousy flavor. So that's okay if it'll come back out. The whole problem with the flavor that comes out of the walls is that it was absorbed into the walls as a positive flavor. But if it came out of the walls into the water and then went back into the walls as a negative flavor, then if it will come back out of the walls next time you cook soup in it or whatever, that's okay. This is a rabbinic decree. After 24 hours, you've entered the area of rabbinics. So we say, one level is to purge it, to heat it till sparks are flying, and then that's called libun. You've heated it that much that you've burnt whatever flavor was inside. Then you have kli rishon, that the vessel was used on the fire, you boiled water inside. So there you say you have to reboil water inside, and the water has to, you can either use a bigger pot, boil it within a bigger pot, or have the water overflow and ensure that it overflows over the sides, and then you say that the flavor came out the same way it came in. And then you have a klisheni. Sometimes you say it wasn't used with, you didn't cook in it. You have a cup. You have a metal cup. You don't cook in that cup, you pour into that cup. So then it's enough to pour into that cup. That's, in a nutshell, the concept of kibboleo kach poleto. Then we have the laws of tevilas kelim, when a vessel goes from non-Jewish ownership to Jewish ownership, provided that the non-Jew owned the vessel for the sake of usage, or the non-Jew produced the vessel, so then it went from a non-Jew to a Jew. So then you have to immerse it in the mikveh waters, assuming it's a metal vessel. If it's made of one of the metals, a glass vessel must be immersed in the mikveh waters rabbinically. You make a blessing, al tvilas kelim, or al tvilas kli, and you immerse it, provided you bought it for the sake of using it. Let's say you bought a cup, a becher, that you're going to give to someone else as a gift. being that you're not going to use it for food, so then it doesn't have to be immersed. Which vessels have to be tabled in a mikveh? Vessels that are used for the final preparation of food and that come in direct contact with the food. Meaning if I have a toaster oven, the grates where I might place my toast, they have to be tabled in the mikveh. But the oven itself doesn't come in contact with the food. I don't have to put that in a mikveh. You're talking about a toaster that you stick the bread into, or I'm talking about a toaster oven that you have shelves.
Stick the bread
into. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. There you get gets problematic. Another area, what?
Buy it from a Jew.
You could buy it from a Jew, and then there are other ways of getting around this. So we said grates. Another thing that comes up is if you buy the electric things that heat water, what are they called? Electric tea kettles. So if it's made of plastic, so fine, but usually it's not made of plastic. You have to have a metal base that heats up the water. So if you have something metal that's the prime part of the vessel, so that then you have to immerse it in the mikveh water. So then you have to let it dry in a way that it will be completely dry so it doesn't get ruined. You have handheld mixers. So you'll say, but the mixer's plastic. Yes, but what grinds up the food? The metal knife of the mixer. So that has to be immersed in the mikveh waters. Do you have to immerse it with the cord, without the cord? Do you have to immerse the whole thing or not? Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. One thing I will tell you, leave it out in the sun for a very long time and turn it over on each side to make sure it completely dries. And if you have a vessel that you think will get ruined by immersing it in the mikveh waters, consult with your local Orthodox rabbi. Do not plug it in when you might get electrocuted or something, right? Make sure you do this safely.
The tines are
detachable.
You would just put those in
a mixer. But what about a handheld mixer?
Yeah, the tines pop out.
So ask your local Orthodox rabbi, because we say that a vessel has to be immersed as a vessel. And the question is, when you pop that out, is that its own vessel? Or is
it a mixer is not a vessel. Nothing goes inside the mixer.
I'm not following you.
A mixer is not a vessel. It's like a knife.
Right, a knife has to be toiled. It doesn't have to be.
But technically, only the cutting part of the knife has to be going in the mixer. It has
I don't think so. I think the whole vessel has to go in the mikveh. The whole knife has to go in the mikveh, and you have to have it in the mikveh for a split second where it's completely immersed in the mikveh. So you let go for a split second so that the complete knife is in the mikveh. There's one more point that people forget, and that is that a child cannot be trusted to tevel correctly. Very often I go to the mikveh and I see people send their kids there. No, a child under bar mitzvah, even if you taught him the halachos, how do you know he did it right? You have to be there.
Assuming that you actually do have to put the entire mitzvah in the mikveh, can you put it inside a plastic bag?
No, the whole idea is that the whole thing gets immersed in the mikveh.
No, it does. You put it inside a plastic bag. You put the entire thing inside the mikveh.
Well, the idea is that whatever has to be in the mikveh has to come in direct contact with the water, and there cannot be a chatzitza. There cannot be anything separating between whatever has to go in the mikveh and the water. The water has to completely envelop whatever it is that goes into the mikveh. Yes. I mean, we even take off the rust, take off any stickers. Let's say it has a sticker on the bottom of the cup, made in China. You know that after a few weeks of washing that cup, assuming you wash your cups, but most people, right? The sticker's going to come off, right? So you don't plan on having that sticker there for life.
So you're saying that the entire mixer has to go.
I didn't say that. I said ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I just said be aware that there's room to discuss that. But what you should do, lemaisa, each person should ask their rabbi. Yeah, this is discussed. It depends if your rabbi is a disciple of Rav Eliashiv or of Rav Osner. Meaning there are different opinions as to how far you have to go. Some opinions say you got to go down to the cord because it's all one vessel. You need the whole vessel in the water. Each person will go in accordance with what his rabbi tells him. Yes. But I wouldn't do it so fast. Meaning I would not say to be stringent to go dunk the whole thing in the mikveh. No. Ask your rabbi. I'm just saying you should be aware that there's room to discuss what has to go in. I mean, there are also opinions that say an electric vessel that's going to get ruined, don't put in the mikveh. So then the question is, what could you do?
If the tines detach and it's still considered one vessel,
So that's a
I
good
mean,
question.
Times you can change them for this kind and that kind.
Right, right. But they have no use unless they're attached to the mixer. Meaning they're not a, you're not going to take them and start...
Do you have to talk about yourself before you hand whisk something?
You're not a vessel.
But the mixer is doing the job of your hand. It's not the...
Right, but we said it has to be a vessel, any instrument. Vessel doesn't have to mean with a bit kibul, with capacity to house something. A vessel, I mean, including a knife or a fork. Every metal knife has to go to the mikveh, and a fork. There's a question whether we have different types of metals that they didn't have in the days of the Torah. So then, do those metals have to be immersed in the mikveh water or not? We don't immerse plastic, for example, just like we don't immerse earthenware, even though today we already do immerse earthenware because our earthenware is glazed, it's coated with glass. So in Chutz La'aretz, most people, as far as I know, back in my day, did not immerse their earthenware, but here in Israel they do. It's a machlokas, how we consider the glass. But here in Israel, the custom is they do immerse their earthenware vessels. I wouldn't make a bracha on an earthenware vessel. I wouldn't make a bracha on a glass vessel, or a peeler, for example, or a knife, or a fork. Once you've bought a vessel that's been purchased from a non-Jew, that comes in direct contact with the final production of food. Yes? One of the metals. One of the metals or rabbinically glass?
The one that where you got the plastic came out, or the metal.
Yes.
The thing I wanted to know was, if you go to a Jewish shop and you buy a glass made in China, it's owned by a Jew previously, where someone gives you a bar mitzvah present or something, which is from a Jew, can you assume that it's fine?
I don't think so. Because usually the manufacturer is not Jewish. The big question, halachically, is can we make a blessing on immersing vessels? Because almost every vessel you're buying was manufactured by some big company. And that big company is owned partially by Jews. Because chances are it's on some stock exchange, and some Jews own a part in it. So the question is, does that constitute real ownership? When you own stocks, does that mean you own a part? Do you really own a part in each cup that the company produces? Or are all the company's assets more like collateral for your stocks? So this is a discussion in Halacha, whether you make a blessing on any vessel you tovel today. Any vessel that you immerse in the mikveh waters. Because the Jewish shop did not buy it for use with the food. The Jewish shop bought it to resell it to you. That's why they're not obligated to immerse it.
What about if someone gave it, a Jew gave it to you, that they used it through their lives?
Can we assume that they immersed it? If they keep Torah and mitzvos, yes.
So,
last Shabbos, I wanted to give a glass cutting board to someone who was hosting us. So how do you do that? I asked someone else to acquire it on their behalf. We have a halacha that one Jew can acquire something on behalf of someone else. Meaning, if I see a book on the floor that's Hefker, I could say, I'm lifting this book to acquire it on behalf of someone else. So I was going to give the glass cutting board to my host and tell him, please lift it and acquire it for the person who's going to be my host by Shabbos day. What's the problem? That the glass cutting board needs to be immersed in the mikveh. You put vegetables on it and you cut them, right? So the vegetables come in direct contact with the glass as they're being prepared for food. If it's not immersed in the mikveh, cannot be used on Shabbos. If it cannot be used on Shabbos, it's muktzeh. If it's muktzeh, I can't bring it to give it to my host. So even though I can make it his, but how could I give it to him? So let me tovel it, but how could I tovel it? Now what I could have done, if I would have been a little bit smarter, which I did previous times, was I took the glass vessel and I gave it to a friend and I said, acquire it for so-and-so who I'm going to give it to. Once he acquired it for him, for that person, now it's owned by the person who will use it. I can't immerse it so long as it's mine because I didn't purchase it for use. I purchased it to give it onward as a gift. It's not chayav in tzvila by me because it's not a vessel that
you can turn it on their behalf.
But if it belongs to them, if I've already made it theirs, then I can travel it on their behalf. Had I been smart enough, I would have done that. I did that once, but this past Shabbos, I forgot to do that. Okay, we're out of time.